now.
Welcome to The Revenue Architects. I'm your host, Jeff Ignacio. In this podcast, we're going to bring incredible business athletes together. We'll explore how to build a go-to-market capability for businesses, no matter the size or shape. We'll remix content from a bunch of different places, bring in guests, deep dive into incredible topics. So with that in mind, I want to thank you for joining us. And now on to this episode of The Revenue Architects. So we're joined today by Keith Jones. Keith is a SaaS veteran who has gone full circle in his career, from ops to sales and then back to ops. He has spent time in vertical SaaS organizations after getting his start in healthcare. A startup warrior through and through, Keith is now at his fifth venture-backed company, running go-to-market systems at Mural. When Keith isn't looking for ways to improve Mural's overall technology strategy, he helps run a nonprofit community called Ride and Raise, organizing virtual athletic events every month and raising money for amazing causes around the country. So Keith, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thanks, Jeff. Glad to be here.
So tell me a little bit about this nonprofit, Ride and Raise. It's super interesting.
Yeah. It's actually, it was actually a very happy accident. It happened right kind of at the height of quarantine. You know, we had all had, you know, most of us, at least in this country, had gone on lockdown. And I like to describe it as we were all kind of starting to feel the quarantine crazies. Especially myself. I live by myself, so I was starting to go a little stir crazy. And a couple friends of mine had asked if I had any interest in doing a live Peloton ride, like arranging, like, hey, let's schedule time to ride together since we can't see each other in person, since we're all staying home and staying on quarantine. And I was like, yeah, absolutely, let's do it. And so we did that, and that was fun. And then another friend of ours was like, hey, what if we challenge people to show up for these rides, and in turn, we will donate to charity if they show up? Like, for each person, we'll donate $5 up to $100. Like, yeah, let's do it. So we did it. $400 raised that ride. And we were like, that was amazing. Like, it just felt so good to not only ride with other people while we're, you know, unlocked down and not able to see each other, but also just a chance to, like, you know, do something not just for ourselves athletically, but for a great cause. And so we decided to do it again. And what was really crazy was the second time around, the people who came back were like, hey, you guys can't be the only ones donating money. How do I give? And that's when we kind of realized we had something. And so we've been doing it every month since, going on just over a year now. And we've raised somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 for various nonprofits and groups around the country that do really, really amazing work. And it's just been an awesome privilege.
So from $400 from that first ride to $20,000, $30,000, That's huge. I actually wonder, you know, what your plans are once the pandemic is over and folks can ride together again. Do you have plans for that shift when the pandemic ends?
That's a great question, right? And it's not unlike operations people like you and I to plan for the future. A few months ago, we actually pivoted slightly away from just Peloton, and we partnered with a technology outfit that built an app specifically for nonprofits. And for these sort of events and fundraising efforts. And so now we have a little bit more of an inclusive program where you sign up for our events, and kind of our flagship event that culminates our challenges is still a live Peloton ride, because that's where we got our start. But the entire challenge is 2 weeks long, and you can run, walk, swim, do whatever, and log your workouts through Apple Health, through Strava, whatever. And that earns you points towards our challenge, and then we give away prizes. Whoever earns the most points. So I feel like we're a little post-pandemic proof, but, you know, we'll see what happens as the world shifts back to a new normal.
It's really cool. I find that maybe there's a world where folks in ops can join as a cohort to one of your events. So those who are listening, maybe we can collaborate with Ride and Raise.
Absolutely. We love that.
So, you know, tell me about Mural and tell me about, you know, your role and how you ended up in Mural.
Yeah. So Mural's, first of all, amazing. Not just because I believe that we have an incredible product that, you know, it's interesting. Our CEO describes it as having a terrible privilege because we grew a lot during the pandemic. And that's because our product was terribly relevant for a time that no one was prepared for, where everyone had to go home, had to be separated. And we, you know, provide a technology that allows you to collaborate no matter where you are in the world, and you don't even have to be on a live session at the same time. You know, it was so we have a great product, and that's one of the things I love about the company. But what I love most about the company is the team and the culture. You know, I've been at Merrill now for about 7 months. I just happened to find them through LinkedIn as they were, you know, experiencing some explosive growth last year, and that they were starting to build out their RevOps team. And I was actually the third person on the RevOps team joining last August. And our team and our culture is just second to none. It's an incredible group of people, incredibly warm, welcoming, talented individuals. But I think my favorite thing above all else is that we have created an atmosphere that allows for failure, allows for us to break things every now and then. It's a little bit less of the, you know, move fast and break things mentality that Facebook made so popular, but more of the we expect things to break from time to time because we're moving so quickly, because we're growing so much, because we're doing so much. And when failure happens, when things break, which they have happened, even some of them at my very hands, you know, we get encouraged by leadership on down, like, it's okay. This is going to happen. Let's work together to make it better. And I couldn't say enough good things about the company and the culture for that reason alone.
That's awesome. And then before Mural, you mentioned you were in ops and sales. Like, can you tell me a little bit about that seesawing before you were in ops, then sales, and back in ops now?
Yeah. So I like to joke that I was in operations when I had no business doing so. I'm a college dropout. And so I was a little bit lost in my ways, to be totally honest with you, early on, you know, my early 20s, and didn't know what I was going to be doing with my life. But I had a penchant for numbers. I was good with technology. I was good with puzzles. And I was lucky enough to be hired by a guy who was running operations at this healthcare company building point of care workstations for nurses. And they were growing like crazy. We're talking, you know, triple digit growth over and over again, year after year. They're just ballooning, busting at the seams. And so he hires me just to kind of be his second hand. And he gives me a first class like business education on the fly. And before I know it, I'm building shipping and sales forecasting in Excel. I'm rewriting processes that we use internally for how to handle customer requests from customers. I joke that I was doing sales ops before I knew what sales ops was, which is what I look back on very fortunately. But it was actually at that company that I had a chance to go into sales, and they gave me a chance to relocate to Atlanta, Georgia at the time to be an account executive after having spent about 2.5 years in the home office in Detroit, Michigan. And I was in sales with them for a little while until I made my jump over to SaaS, where I was an AE at my first startup. And it was there that I actually ended up transitioning back to ops when all of a sudden, after about 6 months as an AE and having done pretty well, we were suddenly found ourselves without a Salesforce admin, without any sort of operations after we lost a critical team member. And so our CEO brought me aside and was like, hey, you want to learn how to do Salesforce? And he's like, sure, why not? Do I still have a quota? He goes, no, just learn how to do Salesforce, but maybe occasionally do a technical demo for these other sales guys who don't know technology at all. I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And that was the beginning of my spin back to operations. And I honestly haven't looked back since.
That's incredible, because one of the things that you mentioned there is having a mentor sort of sponsor you and give you the opportunity to, you know, stretch your wings, stretch your arms, put yourself in a position that you may not be comfortable with. And you found yourself in a career and you roll with the punches. You actually flip that into a sales role, which is actually interesting. Most of the folks that I talk to are in sales who want to flip into ops. And so I'm curious, when you flipped over to a frontline selling role, was there anything that you learned in your ops, I guess, role that kind of contributed to your success as an AE?
Yeah, I credit my original mentor and boss with teaching me how to break down a problem to its simplest elements. And I think that aided me a lot in, you know, some of your more typical discovery, you know, segments of any particular sales cycle. Now, I was in some pretty long sales cycles. Healthcare, for anyone who's ever been in that business or sold into that industry, knows they don't always move as fast as you want to, especially when capital purchases are involved. But I had learned in my, you know, early days in ops how to take a complex problem and break it down to simple initiatives. And I did the same thing with my deals and figured out what are the simple things that I can do to push this deal further. It may not get me the win. It may not definitely won't get it to me tomorrow, but if it even pushes it an inch further, that's an inch that I didn't have the day before. And I found that to yield a lot of success for me in my early days in sales.
So, you know, I'm looking at Miro's website before our call here, and just taking a look, one of the things that stands out to me immediately going to your website is, you know, I see the sign in button at the top and start now free. So I'm actually able to click the start now free and sign up for an app. I haven't talked to anybody on your team, any account executives. So, you know, part of buying software today is being able to on-ramp. And I'm curious, you know, given your previous experience as an AE and now in ops, and now you're at a company where you can easily onboard an application to a customer without talking to a salesperson. What does that look like in terms of that learning curve from your days as frontline selling and supporting a B2B play, and now in what I would consider a product-led growth position?
You know, that's an interesting question. I feel like now it forces an AE to have more of a conversation and less of a lecture. I remember back in my days as a seller in healthcare, you know, I did a lot of selling before the customer ever touched the product. You know, and sometimes, to be frank, that was necessary because of gaps the product had, right? We were a manufacturer of physical workstations, and there were things that those workstations physically didn't do that our customer wanted or needed them to do, but I still had a quota, I still had a number to hit. And so there was a lot of selling and a lot of, you know, influencing that I needed to do before they physically had their hands on the product just to make up for some of those things. Or to get around some things that our competitors would say about us, you know. And now you go into a conversation as an AE today, especially in a product-led organization like Mural, and you have to just understand and realize and accept the fact that your customer has already seen the product. They've already played with it. And unfortunately, they already have some assumptions of their own or potentially even misconceptions that they've made based on their initial experience. Could be something wrong in the product, could just be something that they perceived incorrectly about the product. And you need to be extremely aware that those things could come up early on, and you need to learn, figure out how to flush those out. And so I think it has forced AEs to adapt, at least the ones that are willing to do so. But I also think that it's created a much more interesting conversation for sales at the front end of the cycle.
So it's interesting because when I think about enterprise selling and SaaS websites, you'll typically see a demo button or a contact sales button or a contact us form. And instead, it's a simple button, signing it up the app, logging in, and you're actually into your instance. I totally agree that there's a whole different workflow from the technology side. And then there's a whole different workflow from the go-to-market side. You know, as RevOps and in that space, you know, how is your team position to kind of support that value for a buyer or a prospect who's already seen your product, have already formulated that concept, those misconceptions? Like, what is it exactly that your team takes as top priority to ensure that's a smooth transition from free trial to hopefully to become a paid user?
First and foremost, I think it starts with data, right? It's making sure that when we have someone that we know is in the product and we're essentially charging someone in sales, or in our case, our marketing team, with contacting someone to try and set up a bigger conversation about their usage of Mural or potential usage, that is, it's making sure that person's informed about, you know, hey, how long have they been in this trial? When did they create it? What have they been doing in it since? How much have they actually used it? That kind of goes back to what I said earlier, right, about, you know, this, your customer, your prospect has already seen the product. So they've done something, could be a little bit, could be a lot. We do our best to try and give, not too much, because you don't want to overwhelm any potential individual contributor when they have a lot on their plate and a number to hit. But we try to give them some key insightful data points around, you know, what that person has been doing in the product up until the point that they're having a conversation with them, to lend to that conversation and to inform them of what that person has been up to.
So if we break that down, you have user data, you have usage behavioral data of some sort, and I'm assuming you're looking at feature set data. Like, how is that presently constructed? Because typically in RevOps, you're going to have your CRM, which is going to have your customer and your prospect information, but then your usage data is probably not living in Salesforce. It's living in somewhere else. You know, what does that infrastructure look like for your team? And is that something that your team is focused on completely in terms of ownership, or are you partnering with like product and engineering?
So it's actually marketing operations that we partner with. So we're a bit odd in that we have revenue ops and marketing ops at Mural. Revenue ops is primarily sales and customer success. We also have biz ops. I might come back to that one later on. But marketing ops, you know, they own a lot of technology, but they specifically own Marketo. So that's our marketing automation platform. And I have worked in partnership with them, along with our data and engineering and product teams, in order to create a system where when things are happening in the product, we're feed things to Marketo, which is then being segmented and translated as interesting moments, which we can display and report on natively inside of Salesforce. So we kind of treat it with the same degree of, you know, downloading a white paper versus, you know, using a particular template for a particular type of workshop inside Mural. Those are both kind of interesting moments that we surface up to our go-to-market staff so they can understand what that person's been doing in the product.
I think that's a very intelligent architecture, because when Marketo has, you know, you're using those moments, essentially they're events in the event stream of what a prospect is doing or a customer is performing. And so you're translating that into something that is native right out of Marketo and then is native integration to be fed and displayed right in the Salesforce. That makes it very easy for your sales team to, one, recognize and read kind of the stream of what's happening, and two, from an administrative purpose, from an administrative point of view, for RevOps and marketing ops, it is just using off-the-shelf capabilities. It's just that front end from your product to Marketo that is somewhat custom to you. I think that's really intelligent.
Yeah, I'll be totally honest with you, Jeff. I cannot take full credit for that one. That one goes to our world-class marketing ops team, who I am damn lucky to work with.
Honestly, when you're in RevOps, it's never a one-person show. It's always never. It's always a village, right? It takes to build the entire infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Without a doubt.
Maybe we play it back, right? So obviously, you know, you're working with an infrastructure that has been built over time. Maybe we can replay back to some of the largest, most interesting infrastructural changes that maybe you've been a part of. I'd love to hear a little bit about, you know, what was the situation and the context around what this particular project might have been.
Yeah, actually, I'll hit on one in particular, which has been specifically interesting and extremely relevant given. So I just had a new team member start this week. And so, of course, as you know, as a RevOps professional, you walk into a new company, and specifically if you're working in CRM technology like Salesforce, a brand new org, you've got all kinds of questions. No two Salesforces are the same, right? And so we're trying our best to try and get her as ramped as quickly as possible to get her self-sufficient, but there's a lot to learn there, right? A lot to download, a lot of documentation for her to read around the things that have been done. And so we just actually went through this in one of her onboarding sessions just a few hours ago, actually. But this is one of those things that was an interesting challenge for us on the infrastructure side, but, you know, a fun story at the same time, because it says a lot about our growth, right? What I was doing is I was undoing something that had been done that was the right move at the time. It was the right way to do it because of where Mural was in its stage of growth, where it was in terms of its client base, where it was in terms of the people that it had at its disposal, the technology, and the people to engineer that technology. And, you know, for all of us more seasoned RevOps pros and Salesforce junkies out there, what situation we had is that, you know, in concept, we treated every individual team or department that used Mural like it was its own customer. You could have just been the marketing department, or maybe even a very small subsegment of marketing, say 20, 30, 40, 50 people at Microsoft. We treated you like you were Microsoft at large. And we did the same thing for the product team next to you and data team working out of a different office, or all of us working from home, as we know most of us have been doing for the last year. And so with that, when I walked in the Mural day one, I discovered that we had gone about using the parent-child account hierarchy to support this purpose. And so we had child accounts for every individual team and department that we sold to. And for some, that may not sound like that bad of an idea. It's like, okay, great. Yeah, at least you can see them visually and whatnot. But here's the thing. we do a lot of transactions and we do them quickly, especially with these smaller teams that only have 10, 20, 30 people. You know, our AEs will close those in under a week. And so it's a lot of data and it's a lot of layers when you start talking about parent and child and then opportunities fitting in between. Where does the contact go? I don't know. Did we create the child account on time? Is it labeled correctly? And then don't even get me started about duplicates, because these accounts all look the same. Microsoft Dash Marketing, come on now. So we had a problem, right? But it was a growing pain. It was a factor of us growing so quickly over the last couple of years. But we had to figure out a way to move forward. And so what we ended up doing was incorporating a new custom element that we decided to call a team. It's a custom object, and it's a grouping mechanism for our ops. And we did away with all of these superfluous child accounts, and now we have a true enterprise structure. If you look at Microsoft in our CRM today, you can see Microsoft. You can see LinkedIn as a subsidiary of there since they acquired them. And then you can see all the teams that we've worked with inside Microsoft, or all of the teams within LinkedIn that we've worked with, and the individual transactions that each team has incurred with us as part of their usage. But it was a slug of a effort. I mean, we're talking a month and a half of scope and prep, another month of solicitation and getting feedback and kind of prepping everyone for it because it's such a huge shift. And then another month of work in the background and building everything in a sandbox and testing the living daylights out of it. All said and done, I think we officially started this project sometime in November, like, or maybe late October last year. And we weren't really said and done with it until about a couple of weeks ago in full, once we had completely cleaned out all of the old data from our system after all the changes and new functionality had been introduced. But it was a big effort. It was awesome. It was a team effort, and it was received very well, especially from our account executives, who had always been so confused as to where their opportunities were sitting. Was it on the child account? Was it on a parent account? Was it on a child of a child? Who knew? But we were able to give them a lot more clarity in the CRM by introducing this much more simple structure to our data.
So I think anyone who's listening that is an ops will completely understand, you know, what happens when these subsidiaries to a legal entity, and then what happens even more to, you know, the bring your own software to work situation where you have an employee come in as a personal account, as a free trial, and then pay for their own account, or then later get merged into an enterprise. And so it's an elegant solution that you've chosen. In fact, it's one of the things that we're working on today at my own company, Upkeep. You know, we sell maintenance and reliability software to companies, but they're actually being used on site at a specific location because, you know, folks who are in facilities management. So much like your team, it's very similar. You have these, you know, sibling locations rolling up to a company, and that company may actually roll up to another company. So you have this cross and matrix view of users and who is the ultimate kind of paying account or a master agreement holder.
I was just going to say the biggest takeaway for me was I had to save our AEs and our XDRs. I had to save them time, because beforehand we put the burden on them to manage the account structure. And when they would find a new team, we would make them, you know, require them to go in and create a child account for this design team that we're going to hopefully sell a new subscription to. And we managed with this, you know, more elegant way of this custom object just to automate it all. Because it's not an overly complex piece of infrastructure, which an account easily can become in Salesforce, we were able to just require a couple of key data points. Tell us who the team is, you know, at key inflection points in the buyer cycle, and we would automate for them and create the team record and make sure so it completely saves our users a step. I haven't quite quantified it yet, but I need to go back and see just how much time we're saving these people now that they don't have to create child accounts for every new deal that we close.
It's also probably saving your finance team quite a bit, right? Because hopefully you don't have this huge mix of heterogeneous orders and billing accounts, and it's all kind of crisscrossed. You know, it's the one thing to fix the sales funnel, and there's another thing to work on the post-sale, right? The whole order to cash piece of it.
Yep. Absolutely.
So you talked about your team construct. I'd love to maybe, you know, double click in a little bit. You talked about four different teams, and forgive me if I get this wrong, but marketing ops, revenue operations, biz ops, and data ops. Did I get that right? And I'd love to maybe for you to kind of explore the remit of each of those teams.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So it's interesting, right? So we've got. I'll start with Data because they're the newest team, and those are the ones that are working on basically built. You know, a lot of the SaaS companies have some sort of data warehouse, right? That's owned by our data team, but they are the gatekeepers and the guardians of all the different ways that we are pulling data from various sources, like Salesforce, like Marketo, and a combination of both from the product. And so those are the owners of Tableau. They, you know, their primary customers are anyone in the business that needs, you know, a big picture insight around any particular area that they're responsible for, whether it be someone in customer success or someone in partnerships. And then I get my team and the rest of revenue operations gets a really awesome chance to work with them in close partnership to make sure that that the right data is being pulled in and giving the right context to that. And so that's awesome. So that's the data team. And then the BizOps team is really kind of focused on financial data at large. They're doing a number of different things, but they're somewhat of like the growth function that you might see in RevOps at times, where they're staring down at our ARR modeling and they're staring at our forecasting and they're trying to figure out, you know, what, you know, where can we expect to be as a business, not just as a sales team, because we have multiple revenue streams, right? We have people that we sell to directly, you know, over Zoom or through some sort of phone call or with a big enterprise client. But then we also have people, like you mentioned earlier, that kind of, you know, bring your own software to work. People who are just buying Mural online and paying for it themselves. So there's a lot of work to be done there. And our fantastic BizOps team is doing that. And I get to work with them because a lot of our ARR data comes directly from Salesforce. And then we've got marketing ops. Gosh, I love those guys. They are so cool. So we're set up in a way where, you know, account development, biz development, sales development, whatever you want to call it, we call it account development, but that lives under marketing with us. No mistake either, because our CMO is from Terminus Software originally, you know, the purveyors of account-based marketing. And so he's built an incredible organization and has some amazing leaders, you know, building out that function. And then marketing ops services them at large. But there's a lot of parallel work and a lot of partnership between marketing ops and RevOps, and specifically my team within RevOps and systems. And then I work very closely with the Marketo admin in marketing ops, who works with those admins on my team to make sure the data is flowing properly. Do we need new fields, when we need to add new things to the different pages in Salesforce from various technologies that marketing owns, like Marketo, like Demandbase, like Chili Piper for booking meetings on behalf of sales, those sort of things. So that's kind of how those four teams play together.
It's really refreshing to hear all the different teams that can work together and actually be specialists, right? Because my own team, we've actually set up our own data warehouse as well. And so the whole concept of ETLs and reverse ETLs for my team, I have folks who, you know, our systems admins, they're specialists in their own specific softwares, and to work with, you know, these databases and finding ways for them to get in and out of your system while maintaining, you know, specific rate limits. It's not common, actually. It's not the very first thing that, you know, your ops team is going to leap at. But, mm-hmm. you know, sure enough, everyone needs that data, particularly with usage cohorts or hand raises around these free trials look very promising. Or, hey, someone's just signed up for this account, needs to be potentially stitched up to an enterprise license. I can see where that interplay comes together between all these different teams.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun.
So for those who are in your position today or would like to be, you know, what are some things you think are relevant to, you know, to their future success? What advice would you give someone that is kind of coming up through the ranks?
I think the lesson that I've only learned in the last few years of my career, specific to not only just my role in systems, but in a, you know, largely supportive role, right, where I have internal customers across the business, is learn how to say no with grace, because the reality is that you have to say no more often than you can say yes. And I've been the guy who has said yes more often than he said no. And it's gotten me into a rough position where I've overextended myself, my team, my resources, and what I can get done. And that doesn't leave anybody where they need to be. But when you say no to people, you have to find a way to do it with grace, and you have to find a way to do it with evidence too. So I think that's the biggest piece of advice I would give anyone looking at a role like mine or in a role in RevOps, is just learn how to say no, but to say no in a fact-based and empathetic way, so as to clearly communicate why you're saying no, not just that you're turning them down based on their latest request.
I love that. That makes for great partnership and creates understanding between what is possible or what is feasible based on, you know, the constraints the team is currently facing. Or quite frankly, our roles in RevOps, it's about prioritization, and you can't possibly tackle everything.
Yep. And not only that, but on a very tactical level, find a way to build a queue. I don't care if it's a Google sheet, a doc, hell, it could be sticky notes on your desk. That's not probably the best way to do it, but you know, we know what we're saying. Just find a way to create a running list of all the requests that you're getting. And then second, to your point, Jeff, about prioritization, do not try to prioritize things on your own. That's where you need to ask others, not just your peers, but the people above you and in the particular leadership positions. Because the reality is that you as an individual contributor or even a middle manager, I don't think you are in the best position possible to determine the best priorities. I think those are best done with other people being part of that conversation. And more importantly, you don't want to be the one left holding the bag when you're saying, hey, I can't do this right now because I'm working on X, Y, and Z, when it's a much better position to be in. Like, I can't do this because marketing needs this, or because the CRO has asked for this, this, and this. When we get through these things, we can go to it. So that way you have someone who can back you up as well. Not that it's a game of politics, sometimes it is, but you want to be able to have people understand where these priorities are coming from and that you're not the only one making those decisions.
So we talked about a lot about RevOps, but I want to hear more about you. And I know you're moving to New York pretty soon. Tell me about that.
Yes, I am. Yeah, you know, it's interesting, right? I have been in Atlanta for a really good chunk of my professional career. I love Atlanta. It will always be home for me. For those that have met me in person, and I know we don't have a video today, but I have the skyline of Atlanta tattooed on my arm because of how often that city has just yielded promise and fruit for me personally. So I'll always be a big fan of the Manhattan of the South, as they call it. But I'm on my way up to the actual Manhattan, to the, you know, the city so nice they named it twice, and I can't wait. But it's just a, you know, for me it was taking a step and doing something I hadn't done before. And here I am moving to New York because I haven't done it before. So there's not much else to it, to be perfectly honest with you. It was just felt like it was time to change it up, try a new strategy. You know, not that I wasn't growing in Atlanta, but I wanted to swim in some different waters. And here I am.
So if you're in New York and you're listening, please give Keith a shout. Show him around town.
Please do. Absolutely.
So we have this last segment. I call it the Rorschach test. I'm just going to say a few things. Would love to hear the first thing that comes to your mind. So let me know when you're ready to go.
Oh, this should be fun. Let's do it.
All right. Personalization versus relevance.
Ooh, prioritize personalization, always.
Product-led growth.
Product-led, not product only. That's a lot to unpack there, but.
Oh, you know, we have to unpack that at some point. B2B versus B2C.
Not as important as other things.
MQL, real or not?
Only if your data is good enough.
I think this one would be a good one, but a PQL.
I would say same answer as before, but also only if everyone involved agrees on the definitions.
Full cycle versus SDR assist or ADR assist.
ADR assist every time.
Win-loss reviews.
Absolutely critical and can never be done soon enough.
Pipeline management.
Bane of the existence of all account executives. Make it as easy as possible.
And is cold calling dead?
Absolutely fucking not.
All right, Keith. Appreciate you coming on to the show. Where can our listeners find out more about you?
They can hit me up on LinkedIn at any time. This is a fun little fact. I think I have one of the most relevant LinkedIn profiles for our particular profession. LinkedIn.com/in/revenue operations will lead you right to my profile. Snagged that bad boy about 6-7 years ago when vanity URLs first became a thing, and I will never give it up. And then I'm on social, on Instagram, but LinkedIn's probably the best way to get a hold of me.
And I know you and I chat quite a bit on Wizard of Ops, the community as well.
If you're in WizOps, that is a great way to get a hold of me. I spend a lot of time in there, just whether it's connecting, sharing ideas, or just like having fun social conversations with folks like yourself and others. I'm a huge promoter and big fan of WizOps.
All right, Keith. Appreciate you coming on to the show.
Thanks, Jeff. It was an honor to be here. Appreciate you having me.